perceptions that people form around the past are based on their experiences with them. And the way in which we engage with monuments sort of gives them a new meaning. Hello everybody, this is Eric Chopra.
And this is Kudrat Singh.
And we welcome you to another episode of the For Old Time's Sake podcast by Ithyasology. So Kudrat, in a previous episode, we talked about the magic of the museum, right? And how the experience of visiting an institution like the museum, where you see so many histories literally summarized before your eyes, compartmentalized, museumized, how this is a very enriching experience and a very interesting one at that. And we thought that for this episode, we look at the idea of a monument. And not in the sense that we start to go into these very multi-layered historical backdrops that each of these monuments have, but the relationship yet again that people establish with these sites, right? And I wanted to pick some examples from Delhi, where you literally are stumbling upon the past all the time.
Yeah.
Like you'll be walking down a street in a very contemporary setting, and there it is, a 16th century tomb right in front of you. And all of these, you know, many tombs and palaces and fortresses and wells, all of them have really taken up so many stories in themselves as they have witnessed epochs, as they've witnessed centuries, and they've literally traveled through time with us. So I've always found that process very interesting, where you walk into a monument and you're sort of in the 16th century, or the whole concept of time and space, it gets puzzled, and that makes it more interesting.
Yes, the experience of going to a monument is definitely very interesting and very personal as well. And it's quite interesting to see the kind of relationships that people often forge with monuments. So for some, it could be a leisure time activity. You maybe go there once. For others, for families, for communities, it could be a yearly ritual to visit a monument. For yet others, it could be a religious visit to a monument. And then, of course, there's the relationship that history aficionados forge with monuments. You know, whether you're going there as a student, whether you're going there as an archaeologist, as a researcher. But Eric, what I think you find particularly fascinating is when monuments turn into haunted spaces. How does that happen?
Well, I think that's a very long conversation for another day and for another project. More on that later. But since you did bring up the otherworldly aspect of it, what I like to call it, I think it would be nice if we start off talking about Firoz Shah Kotla.
Absolutely.
Right? So Firoz Shah Kotla is this monument in Delhi with many, many layers of history. It was set up by the Sultan Firoz Shah Tughlaq in the 14th century. But what is very interesting is that its history actually goes back to the time of Ashoka, because what you see towering over this medieval fortress is a 2,000-year-old pillar with the edicts of Ashoka. More interesting, though, is the fact that as of today, the popular memory at Firoz Shah Kotla is neither of Ashoka nor of the medieval Sultan. What people think of Firoz Shah Kotla is as this abode of the otherworldly. They believe that jinn saints, these entities made of smokeless fire, they are the ones who inhabit Firoz Shah Kotla. And each Thursday, you would see at this monument, people from all across Delhi come in there with the hope that these jinn saints will listen to them, that they will help them out. So they write letters to them, you know, they stand in front of the structure that holds the Ashokan pillar, which is known as actually the saint of the pillar or the Lathwale Baba. But before this pillar was the head of the jinn saints at Firoz Shah Kotla, it was an Ashokan pillar. And I think it begs a mention here to talk about what do these pillars stand for on their own right? What was it that Ashoka was trying to say through these pillars? And what do the edicts basically mean? Kudrat, I think you'd be able to take us through that.
So Ashoka, of course, Eric, was one of the most prominent rulers of the Mauryan Empire. which existed around the 4th to the 2nd centuries BCE. And why we know so much about Ashoka is because he left behind many edicts, and these can roughly be divided into major and minor rock edicts and into pillar edicts. So a pillar edict is like the one that we just spoke about, which is at Firozshah Kotla. And there's about 6 or 7 pillar edicts in total. A recurrent theme in many of these inscriptions remains the idea of Dhamma. And Ashoka's Dhamma was propagated far and wide. So not only do we have inscriptions from all across the Indian subcontinent, but also as far as Afghanistan. And while many of these pillars do contain inscriptions, we also have examples of some that seem to have been purely decorative. And all we have on them is a lustrous surface and usually a capital on top.
Yes, but the ones that do have his inscriptions, as has been established by every scholar who has ever worked on Ashoka, is that why his pillar edicts stand out, why he stands out, is because of his very strong PR. You know, he is the voice in these pillars. And he's speaking in a very majestic way. So literally so many of them just start off with, "Thus speaks the king." And he goes on to list what he believes is the righteous way of living, Dhamma. And I remember from one of our conversations back in college when we were doing our class on ancient India and Ashoka, it was that, you know, the placement of these pillars, the height of these pillars, it wouldn't really be possible for people to just stand there and read what's written on them, right? Yeah. Because they would start on the top. So the idea was that most probably there were these Dhamma Mahamatas, right? These officers from the Mauryan Empire who would stand next to these pillars and they would disseminate the message of Ashoka.
Yes, so while it is difficult to say how the logistics would have worked out, mm-hmm. what we know for sure is that a large number of themes were covered in these pillars, in these rock inscriptions, and they ranged from major events in Ashoka's life, and important among them being the Kalinga War, which he himself says in an inscription that he now deplores, or something like protection of animals, you know. So quite a vast range of ideas are being expressed by the emperor in these pillars. But Dhamma is the one theme that continues almost throughout. And another general feature about these inscriptions is that usually they have a template where they carry 6 edicts. And why the pillar at Firozshah Kotla is particularly noteworthy is because it is the exception in that there is also a 7th edict on this pillar.
Yes, and this was a pillar that Ashoka had originally placed in Topra, but it was brought to Delhi by Firozshah Tughlaq in the 14th century when he was building the city of Firozabad, right? And this is one of the many cities of Delhi, you know, because Delhi is a city of cities. So you have Firozabad that was being built when Firozshah Tughlaq was ruling. And he noticed this pillar. He decided to bring it to Delhi, and there was an entire process, you know, which we would recommend reading Upinder Singh's Ancient Delhi for, in which she talks about how the pillar was really brought to Delhi. But as we mentioned before, is that while this pillar continues to tower over this fortress, the kind of relationship, though, that has been established with the pillar is very different than its intended meaning. And that is what happens with monuments, right? The perceptions that people form around the past are based on their experiences with them. And the way in which we engage with monuments sort of gives them a new meaning, because as we said in the beginning of the episode, you are stumbling upon history all the time. And once you meet it in its most tangible form, you're going to do some meaning making. And Firozshah Kotla stands as an example. And it is actually Kanan Taneja who's done phenomenal work on Firozshah Kotla. And he talks about how the jinn saints of Firozshah Kotla are these anti-patriarchal father figures. And he also talks about how these jinn saints sort of evoke the memory of the Sufi ethic of Garib Nawazi, which, as he says, I quote, "hospitality to strangers, which made Sufi shrines places of hospitality open to all," unquote. So it is indeed mesmerizing to see how people have contributed to the transformation of this medieval fortress with an ancient pillar to this space of hospitality, of devotion, and of seeking justice.
And such is the connection that the people have forged with this monument over the decades that even today, especially on Thursdays, which Eric and I have witnessed actually, people carry candles and flowers and food all for the jinn that is supposed to inhabit the complex. They write letters to the jinn saint in the hope that their wishes will be granted.
Absolutely. So indeed, it is a very personal and interesting connection that is constantly being forged with history. And in the case of Firoz Shah Kotla, we are talking about the jinn saints who inhabit the place. But there are also cases where people start to live in monuments, right? We know the very popular case of Malcha Mahal. Yet again, a monument that goes back to Firoz Shah Tughlaq. Poor Firoz Shah Tughlaq has so many monuments to his name that have just become these spaces of the otherworldly. But the Malcha Mahal has a equally puzzling story wherein this woman lands up at the New Delhi railway station. She says that she belongs to the family of Nawab Wajid Ali Shah, the Nawab of Lucknow. And she goes back drawing her lineage to that moment in time and says, you know what, I need a house. And well, she's offered multiple offers, but she ends up living in this hunting lodge in the middle of a forest, the Central Ridge Forest, right? And as of today, like many other monuments in Delhi, it is deemed haunted. But this is special because there are actually haunted tours being held here, like these specially curated haunted tours. I actually went on two of them. But yet again, that's for another story. While speaking about people who start living in monuments or start appropriating monuments, I think it's important to say that this is not something that began with Vilayat Mahal coming to the New Delhi railway station. It is a practice that goes back in time, and we'll go back to our favorite era of Kudrats as she takes you through the saga of Thomas Metcalf and how he ends up appropriating the medieval tomb of Kuli Khan and making it into actually a honeymoon retreat.
So Thomas Metcalf, very interesting story regarding him, was an agent of the Governor General, and he was intended to keep an eye on the Mughal Emperor, who was based in Delhi at the time. And what he ends up doing is taking up this place very close to where Bahadur Shah Zafar was staying, called Kuli Khan's tomb. And he converts this tomb into almost a resort for himself. And the justification often for acts such as these was for preservation of historical sites. And Metcalf actually renamed this tomb. He called it Dil Khusha, or Heart Delighting. And according to his eldest daughter, he made no use of the ground floor below which the tomb lay. And the living area was actually on a higher level within the tomb. And of course, there was a whole entourage supporting this British civil servant as he resided at this location. And for anyone who's interested in this story, you should actually read up Sylvia Shorto's work, particularly this article called A Tomb of One's Own, where she makes an interesting comparison between the places that British officials took up as residences.
Yes, and I mean, Sylvia Shorto's work looks at the way in which there was this appropriation and manipulation of these very visible elements of style from Mughal buildings, monuments, and like in this case, even tombs. And Kudrat, actually, there has been a virtual tour of this particular tomb from that one episode of Kisse Dilli Ke that I did, in which we take you through how the monument looks like, what are the surroundings like, and where it's located. It's actually located in Mehrauli Archaeological Park, which incorporates many other monuments, like the very famous tomb of Jamali Kamali, another monument known for this story of being haunted. But what has happened quite recently is that this saga of making the tomb of Kuli Khan picturesque has not really ended. It has continued because now there is a cafe over there, right under the steps of the tomb. The entire place has been renovated, the particular tomb. There has been restoration work. And quite literally, the Qutub Minar peaks over this area. So it creates a very beautiful, surrounding the pitch. It's very picturesque. And you see, like at so many monuments, people going there for now wedding photo shoots and a lot of picnics happening now. So Mehrauli Archaeological Park, we have been doing heritage walks for so long, right?
Yeah.
Kudrat, but it has always been one of those locations in Delhi that is not visited as much by tourists or by people who want to explore the monuments of Delhi. And now, because of Kuli Khan's tomb being sort of springing back into popular imagination with its restoration and the addition of the cafe, and with the ticket counter now that is only for Kuli Khan's tomb, not Mehrauli Archaeological Park, it has changed the way in which people are now approaching the monument.
It definitely has, Eric, because so far what we'd seen was that despite Mehrauli Archaeological Park's proximity to Qutub Minar, it remained largely neglected by public visitors. And now that a section has been ticketed, we see a marked difference in the way that the site is treated by visitors. So Kuli Khan's tomb, for example, now looks obviously, you know, much cleaner, much better preserved. It's definitely not as dilapidated as the Baulis, which are also located in the same complex. And neither is it locked away like a large portion of Jamali Kamali's tomb is.
Yes, I mean, it's called the Jamali Kamali tomb, but the tomb part of it is the one that's been sort of kept in secrecy.
Yeah, which is invisible to the visitors there. So this does look like it might be a positive reinforcement of the fact that the other sites also require the same amount of care. At the same time, this commercialization of historical sites also has a bearing on the way that the monument is perceived. So the entire journey of this monument, from first being converted into a colonial official summer residence to now becoming this overly romanticized location, there is a loss of the historical story behind it, and that it is indeed a tomb.
Yes, and that seems to be the case of many monuments hosting tombs. But there is, of course, a splendor to the way that they have also been made, right? Like, for example, the tomb of Humayun, it is supposed to be this majestic monument meant for the purpose of people visiting it, and people continue to do so till today. It's one of the most overwhelmingly beautiful sites in Delhi. So yes, while there is this process in which we have to visit these monuments and appreciate their beauty, we should also not forget that there is a very complicated, layered story behind each one of them.
And it is these stories that we endeavor to bring to you at Itihasology and through the For Old Time's Sake podcast. Thank you for listening to your hosts, Kudrat Singh
and Eric Chopra.
And we'll be back soon with another episode.